You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Larry Sinclair from Sinclair News LS News Group. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Larry, you, of course, were in the news several years ago about some allegations against now President Obama. Before we get into that, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are, where were you born, and run through your life in as quick or slow fashion as you'd like to?
Well, my name is Lawrence, or Larry Sinclair. I was born in Camden, South Carolina in 1961. Spent the first 15 years of my life in South Carolina before heading out west. I currently reside in Port Orange, Florida, where I try to operate SinclairNews.net and LSNewsGroup.com, which is an independent online media or news organization. I do a talk radio program Monday through Friday on the Rents Radio Network called Through the Mirror with Larry Sinclair, and am currently finishing up the final touches on my soon-to-be-released follow-up to my first book, Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder, with When One Man Stands, that will be out on September 18th.
Okay. So you were born in South Carolina, you said, right? A town called Camden. I guess Camden is most well known nowadays for Camden, New Jersey, that horrific town that has been destroyed by its denizens. But Camden, where is that exactly in South Carolina?
Well, Camden, South Carolina is the county seat for Kershaw County. It's approximately 30 miles east-northeast of the capital, Columbia. It's got a history to it. Historic Camden was actually the first fort that was built to stage off the British and still sits where it originally sat. It's historical for Andrew Jackson during his military days as well, and it also holds the Camden Military Academy, which I managed to avoid being put in at a young age.
Do you have any connections with your hometown?
I still keep in touch with friends that I've known since I was a kid. I still have some family in the area. Every now and then I will swing in between trips north to D.C. or Pennsylvania and stop in and say hello to people. But outside of that, Camden's not a place that anyone who is looking for something more exciting or something that will occupy your time, it's not that type of place to where you're going to find it. If you're looking to just get by and be content with what's available, then hey, it's perfect for you. But it hasn't been my type of residence area for quite some time. In fact, I could not have left sooner if I had wanted to. I left at 15, so it's definitely not a place I want to set roots in.
I got you. And are your folks still living?
My father is deceased. He actually lived there his entire life. My mother is currently in Louisiana.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear about your dad. Are you still in touch with your mom?
Actually, my mother and I speak almost on a daily basis. She is proud of the fact that she thinks that I got my stubborn streak and my refusal to back down from anyone from her.
You grew up in South Carolina. You got out of there when you were 15, and now I guess you're either 50 or 51, right?
I am 50. I will be 51 in about 2 months.
From 15 until when you came onto the political scene, I guess that was in 2008, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Between those times, anything significant happened in your life?
I just basically lived my life. I have some indiscretions with the law, you might want to call them. Other people refer to them as a criminal history, which is fair because it is, in fact, crimes and convictions. I have been portrayed as having a 27-year career criminal crime record, which is not anywhere close to the truth. At 18, got involved in writing checks that I knew didn't have the money in the bank to cover, and eventually was charged with theft and pled guilty. I've done a couple of stints within correctional facilities in the state of Arizona, Florida, and Colorado. My criminal record actually encompasses the years of 1980 through 1986, and unless my math is off, I don't think that adds up to a 27-year career criminal history, but let people decide for themselves. Spent a few years in Mexico in the later years. I have lived in just about every place you could possibly want to live in this country. When I left South Carolina, like I said, I went out west to Colorado with my mother. From there, I went to Arizona, California, Texas, Minnesota, New Jersey, Delaware. I've just lived.
Here you are, you're living your life, doing whatever you're doing. You had a couple of run-ins with the law, like many people do. Nothing serious. You did a couple of things that were stupid, and you admitted that you did them, and you paid the price, right?
Exactly.
Is it true that there's a state or a few states that have an arrest warrant out for you?
There is a 2001 warrant in the state of Colorado, which is restricted to the jurisdiction of the state of Colorado. I have a copy of the warrant in my possession. I only found out about it when I was crossing the U.S.-Mexican border one day, and immigration had stopped me and says, well, wait a minute, something popped up. And they contacted Colorado authorities, and at that time were informed that the warrant itself was non-extraditable. It was something that if I was stopped within the jurisdiction of Colorado. It became an issue in the 2008 campaign because those who didn't appreciate my allegations against Barack Obama tried to make hay with it. They began contacting Colorado officials, the district attorney's office out of the 10th Judicial District in Puebla, demanding that they extradite no matter where I'm at, making ridiculous claims on the internet. I had been in contact with the district attorney's office at a Grand Rapids, Michigan rally that Obama was taking part in. In October of 2008, I was stopped by the Grand Rapids police outside of the rally because I was interrupting Obama's speech with a megaphone. And I was told that I needed to contact Colorado because every time they pull you over, they run a check. And they told me the same thing, that they're not going to extradite. I spoke with the assistant district attorney by the name of James Corsi with the Pueblo District Attorney's Office repeatedly throughout the 2008 campaign cycle, offering to go to Colorado, turn myself in, bond out, and let this matter take its course. The assistant district attorney by the name of James Corsi, on October 3rd of 2008, repeated what he had told me months earlier on the phone, which was, do not come to Colorado. Do not waste the money, the time, and the effort to come out here. The charges are going to be dismissed. When that was made public, within 24 hours, that case had been taken out of Corsi's hands and put into actually one of his subordinates' case files. And this subordinate apparently has political drive, or did have political drive, and he insisted that he was not dropping anything. I have not avoided this thing. I have worked with the district attorney's office since I first found out about it, which was back in 2004, I believe. I've provided the district attorney's office with more than enough evidence to show that their complaint is completely unfounded. Because of political harassment, and political harassment only, is the only reason that warrant still exists this day. They've recently had an election and have elected a new district attorney in the area, and what they decide to do with it is up to them. But I have done exactly what I was told to do by the district attorney's office, which is not to waste the money, which I didn't have the money to begin with, but not to waste the money to make a trip out there for something that they can not prosecute.
And what is the actual matter?
What it is a former neighbor and friend, along with a former roommate, signed over their tax refund checks to pay a debt that they owed for furniture that they bought and money that was loaned to buy an automobile at a car auction in Puebla. This took place in 2000. They waited until 2001 to claim that their tax refund checks had been stolen and forged by me. I provided the district attorney's office with credit card receipts showing the purchase at the auto auction in Pueblo, off of Pueblo Boulevard, that showed the exact amount of money that was paid to buy this young man an automobile at the time. And I provided the district attorney's office with police reports from the state of Texas out of El Paso, where the individual's sister-in-law had filed a false police report there, accusing me of stealing a truck that they had sold to me because they didn't want to lose it in yet another repossession. They decided, apparently after their finances got in order, that they wanted me to give the truck back to them. I refused to do that unless, of course, they reimbursed me for the payments that were made and the repairs that were made. And because they couldn't get it any other way, they filed an actual auto theft report in October of 2000. But the detective with the El Paso County Sheriff's Department had already been in touch with me. He already had the payment receipts for the payments made on the vehicle, the fact that they had delivered the vehicle to me on, I believe, April 1st of the year 2000, and the charges were originally filed, and then he immediately took them out of the system. So after they couldn't get their truck back that way, approximately 9 months later, all of a sudden, the sister files complaint in Colorado note alleging that I stole her tax refund checks and forged them. They were deposited into my bank account. They were co-signed by me for that purpose. I've never denied that they were deposited there. However, they were never stolen. They were never forged. And if people would stop and actually look at the information that's available rather than just simply jumping and saying, oh, he stole somebody's tax checks, they might not be preaching as much right now about the Colorado thing.
And that's the only state that has any issues.
That is the only outstanding warrant of any kind that anyone has any knowledge of, or that, in all honesty, according to the United States Secret Service, that there's any record of. Let me back up a minute. Let's go to 2004, the Democratic National Convention. You have a fairly unknown Illinois senator who is making a speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. And that fairly unknown senator, state senator, is Barack Obama. And you have me sitting in my living room in Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, watching the convention on TV, and almost falling on the floor, realizing that an individual that I had engaged in consensual sexual acts and drug activity in 1999 was now right there in front of my face on the TV screen, giving a keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. Imagine my surprise. Now, people in 2008 asked me when I told them that's the first I ever realized who this person was. After the meeting in 1999, people say, well, why didn't you say anything then? And what people don't seem to understand is I have lived a life to where I know people who are in politics, who are in the corporate world, who are even in the church, that if I wanted to go out and simply tell things about them for the purpose of trying to hurt them or whatever, I could do that. There's one thing you learn living in the border states. There's also something you learn by living in Mexico. And that is, just because people are in politics or in the corporate world doesn't make them above engaging in things that most people would say, oh, well, he's too good to know people like that. What people don't understand is people who engage in these things, who participate in illicit drug activity, or who engage in extramarital affairs, of course, when they do that, that's exactly the type of person they associate with. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. But this is what happened in 2004. That's how I realized that the young man I had met and had a couple of sexual encounters with and engaged in the use of cocaine with in 1999 in Chicago, while visiting to watch my godson graduate from Navy basic training in Great Lakes.
Let's go to the time that you met him. Where was this and where were you in your life at that time?
It was in November of 1999. It was in Chicago. Where I was at that point in my life is I was on parole from the Colorado Department of Corrections, finishing out my sentence from a 1986 conviction. I was traveling. Earlier in the month, I had actually traveled to South Carolina with permission. What people did not know was that I was actually involved in moving large quantities of marijuana and cocaine from Colorado and New Mexico to the East Coast. That's where I was in my life.
What was a conviction in Colorado about?
It was unauthorized use of a financial transaction device, which specifically means that I use someone's credit card without having the authority to do so.
Okay.
The second charge was second-degree forgery, which if people would take the time to actually look at the transcripts of the court record, you would see that even though I pled guilty to it, at the time of pleading guilty, I specifically asked the judge that I wasn't sure that forgery was an accurate charge, considering the fact that I never signed anyone's name other than my own. We did appeal that particular guilty plea, and the Colorado Supreme Court and Court of Appeals had determined that we had waited beyond the time frame for appealing it. So it was left to stand, which it didn't matter, because the only argument was is I wanted to make it clear that I did not sign anyone's name other than my own. Like I said, I was on parole.
Mm-hmm.
I had traveled to South Carolina with permission. Only I had promised my godson Lee that I would actually be there in South Carolina for his high school graduation. I could not make that. I knew he was joining the Navy, and I swore on everything that I loved in life that I would be there when he graduated basic training. I had returned from South Carolina, and rather than go through the process of notifying my parole officer that I need needed to travel to Chicago. And because the time constraints, I ended up getting on a flight out of Colorado Springs late the night of November 2nd, flying into Chicago by way of Salt Lake City, Cincinnati, Louisville, and then O'Hare. I was in Chicago. I had already made arrangements to use the services of Five Star Limousine Service, which I got out of the phone book, and had already hired them for a couple of nights before Lee even graduated from basic training.
Larry, why did you rent a limousine? What was the purpose of that?
Well, the purpose of renting the limo, one, was because I was making enough money moving illegal contraband across the country to where I could afford to actually take Lee out once he graduated from basic training. I have always been adamant that I will not drink and drive under any circumstances. Limos were the means in which you could go out, you could drink, you could get drunk, and you wouldn't have to worry about getting into an accident or going to jail. It wasn't unusual for me to do this. I had already used the services of First Class Limo Service out of Columbia, South Carolina months earlier on my trips back to South Carolina and continued to use them throughout the year of 2000. It was something that I would do. It was something that I did not have a problem doing, and it was something that sometimes I actually enjoyed doing.
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Before the 5th of November, which was Friday, before the graduation, Lee could not leave the Great Lakes Navy training facility. So his grandmother and his aunt, who I have known since childhood, they had arrived the day after me, and they were staying at another hotel in another area close to the training facility. I was actually staying at the Comfort Inn and Suites in Gurnee, which was the closest that I could find to the event at the last minute. So we went out the first night that they got into town. We took Five Star out and went around Chicago. And I had talked to the limo driver on the very first night and explained that even though I had made reservations to have them available throughout the week, that if Lee was not able to leave the base on Saturday, that I would still use them, and that if he knew anyone that lived in the Chicago area that would enjoy just going out and partying and showing me around. There was never any implications that any type of sexual actions were hinted at or anything like that.
Okay, now let me just get this straight here. This is November 1999, right?
Mm-hmm.
You came into Chicago what day? November 2nd, right?
I actually arrived in Chicago early morning, November 3rd. I had flown out of Colorado Springs Airport on November 2nd. It was, I believe, Delta's last flight out of the Colorado Springs Airport that evening. And that flight actually took me to Salt Lake City. And I can say this with conviction because I ended up having an extensive layover in Salt Lake City. And Salt Lake City Airport at the time was selling all of this 2000 Olympic game collectibles, you know, the shot glasses, the mugs, and all of this stuff, because I'd actually bought one of the shot glasses. The flight from Salt Lake City took me into Cincinnati, St. Louis, and then on into Chicago O'Hare.
Okay, you get in on Wednesday, November 3rd,
mm-hmm.
and your godson is graduating from Great Lakes, Illinois, basic training on Friday, November 5th.
Correct.
Okay.
I rented a car from Hertz Rent-A-Car at Chicago O'Hare. The car itself was a Mazda. Color was blue. The tags were expired. What people need to understand is I did have a vehicle at my disposal. However, I was not in the mood to be driving around Chicago trying to party.
Right.
So I did rent Five Star Limo Services. Like I said, Pam and Delma, which is Lee's grandmother and aunt, and myself, we went out the night that they arrived. We took Lee out on Friday the 5th after the graduation. Saturday, Lee was not able to go out, or he actually was with his family. I'm almost at the point to where he wasn't allowed to leave the base, and that's the position that I've always held.
Right.
It could be different than that, but that's the way I remember it happening, because I ended up using the limo service on Saturday the 6th alone. So it just happened to be on Saturday, the driver, again, Jagir Mutani, with Five Star car limo, had contacted me before picking me up, letting me know that he had a friend that was interested in showing me around Chicago. So he picked me up at the hotel, which was in Gurnee. We drive into Chicago. I'm not really paying a whole lot of attention to streets or street signs. At that time, that's something I could care less. If I'm not driving, I don't care where I'm at because I don't need to remember how to get the hell out. But anyway, we're driving in. We get into Chicago. I know it's a one-way street because he opens the rear door on the driver's side to let me out of the limo. When I'm stepping out of the limo, there's a young, skinny black man standing there that is introduced to me by name, by Barack Obama. The name doesn't ring any bells to me. I'm not from Chicago, never lived there. I'm not into Chicago politics. And contrary to a lot of the Obama faithful's arguments that this man was just too famous in 1999 to even risk associating with scumbags like Larry Sinclair, don't really know much about Barack Obama's history because in 1999, this was one broke-ass Illinois state senator.
Okay.
This was an individual who not only associated with scumbags like Larry Sinclair, but actually associated with even bigger so-called scumbags.
Right.
If the media had taken the time to walk through Chicago's gay community and talk to people and not be set out to destroy their lives with information that they were provided, the media probably would have known a little bit more about Obama's background rather than just pumping up dreams of my father or the audacity of hope. What people need to understand is this is a man who, despite the fact that he had his first daughter who was almost a year and a half old, was also having severe marital problems with Michelle, and things were not hunky-dory and all snuggly and lovey on the home front.
This fellow Obama, or at least one of his names, is Barack Hussein Obama II, and he was ostensibly born August 4th, 1961, in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I'm reading this from Wikipedia, of course. This is all disputed. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
His name, his date of birth, and his place of birth. It looks like he married Michelle Robinson in 1992, and his first daughter, Malia, was born in 1998.
In July.
And Sasha was born in 01. This happened again. I'm going to look at the calendar.
In November of 1999.
Give me that date that this was the Saturday. This was November 6th.
Saturday, November 6th.
Saturday, November 6th, 1999. How did you remember this limo driver's name? Did you have a card or anything? Did you write down his name? Do you have a diary or how did you remember?
Actually, what I had with me is I had some old credit card files. If you go through my file cabinets or my files, you will find paperwork, receipts, letters, and stuff from 30 years back.
Right.
I would be willing to bet you could find some stuff that goes back even further than that,
right.
Probably close to 45 years.
Wow, so moving around as much as you did, you lugged all this stuff with you.
I don't lug furniture and appliances or electronics other than my computer right now, but anytime I move, my paperwork, everything I have on paper goes with me. Some of it's gotten lost or misplaced along the way, but I still have quite a bit of it. But it wasn't so much having to remember, because a friend of mine that was living in Chicago at the time had done some work with them, and that helped me remember exactly who the driver was. I did have credit card records from the original night, the first night that we took it out, because at one of the credit cards that I was using, the driver claimed that the card was declined, and we ended up paying him in cash. And then only later, after returning from Chicago, did I find out from my credit card records that the credit card company had been charged as well. So I had actually filed a claim on that particular charge. So that's how I knew who I was referring to.
His name was on the credit card?
The name was actually on the dispute.
What kind of a name is that? Did you know that?
Indian.
Okay. The door opens, and here's this skinny black guy. Did he come into the limousine then?
No, actually, he was standing outside of a bar. We went in, and I've tried to get records from Citigroup so that I could actually give the correct name of the bar, because there would be purchase records on those credit card statements. But Citigroup has, since 2008, steadily claimed that they no longer have those records, so that they're not available. I find that to be questionable, but we went into the bar. It wasn't really a long period of time. We went in, we sat down, had a drink, started talking. It was all small talk. There was nothing that would indicate that he was a Illinois state senator. He did refer to himself as being in public service, but you know what? You can be a dog catcher and be in public service.
What type of a bar was it?
It was an upscale, kind of laid-back lounge. They did have music. It was not something that you would see a whole bunch of winos going into. It had some class to it. In fact, I would almost be willing to say that I had been there the first night that we went out in the limo with Lee's grandmother and aunt. And to this day, I've said that I want to say it was Alibis, but I can't say that and be 100% certain. I was even trying to find a couple of shot glasses. This is how desperate I was to prove that I was actually telling the truth in 2008. I started calling family and friends who I knew had been given some of my glass collections before I moved out of Colorado in 2000, just to see if one of them still had the actual shot glasses that I had ended up buying off the bar the first night.
Did you ever think about going back there to the town to look for it?
You know, this goes back to when I said I really wasn't paying attention to where I was driving. If I am driving somewhere, and this is something that I learned from a job that I used to hold, but if I'm driving somewhere, I actually pay attention to things around me on the way there because they serve as markers so that you know where you're at the next time. But when I'm not driving, I don't do that. I wish I had have done that, but I don't.
Is your hunt for this place done?
Yeah, because I think we're far beyond that at this point. A gentleman that did an interview with me on Tuesday asked me the same question, if I was interested in or if it was my desire to continue to push to provide even more documentation on the truthfulness of my accounts. And I told them that at this point, I would love for people to be able to see records that I think do still exist, but I don't have the money and the resources
right.
to force these companies to turn those records over. But I'm at the point now to where I think it's not so much anymore. I think just what has happened since making the allegations in 2008 serves as enough to make people really start to question the honesty of Barack Obama, the campaign itself, and the media in how they reported information about this guy.
Right, or didn't report information about the guy.
Exactly.
Let's get back to the bar. What time is this so about?
It was in the evening, I want to say, and don't hold me to this because other people were trying to pin me down to exact hours. I'm not going to do that. I would say it was in the early evening. I know it was dark already. I know that the limo driver had picked me up at around 6:30 or 7. It would have been a good 45-minute, if not longer, drive into Chicago from the Gurnee suburb. It was early evening.
Okay. What were you drinking?
What I always drink, Grey Goose or Absolut.
Okay. And what was he drinking?
I believe he was drinking Crown Royal. I may be mistaken, but my memory serves me that he was actually drinking Crown Royal. The conversation was brief. Like I said, there was nothing that was real personal or detailed. But all of a sudden, I had made a comment. I'd made the comment to him that I could really use a line to wake up.
By that, you mean a line of blow, cocaine.
Exactly. By saying that, it was clear to me by his response that he knew exactly what I was talking about because he actually asked me if I was referring to coke, and I told him I was. And he had said that he had a source he could actually provide that. So we get out. He makes a phone call. We get back in the limo. He tells the driver where we're going. I would say we drove approximately 30, 45 minutes max. Before we pulled over, stopped, he gets out and says he'll be back. And about 5, 10 minutes later, he shows back up with an 8-ball of coke that I had given him $250 to purchase.
Okay, and for the benefit of the listeners, tell him what 8-ball is.
An 8-ball basically is 1/8 of an ounce. Just like a quarter is a quarter, just like a half is a half, it is 1/8 of an ounce. An ounce is 28 grams. 1/8 of that would be what, 3.7? It's referred to as an 8-ball. So he comes back, he hands me an 8-ball of coke. I have a CD tray from a compact disc, and I would be willing to bet that it was a Los Temerarios CD because I traveled with a lot of Spanish language music on disc. And I start to set up a line with the CD tray resting on his knee. As I'm doing this, the CD tray is actually resting on his left knee. Yep, his left knee.
Okay.
So I start to do a line. In the process, I start moving my hand. and this is what people challenge, and I tell people, look, when you're openly gay, you always have been gay. You know instinctively who you can or cannot get away with making physical advances towards, or at least you think you know. But one thing that I know for a fact is when one man starts rubbing his hand up another man's thigh, heading towards his crotch, if that man's not interested, he's not just going to sit there and let it happen. He's going to pull away or else he's going to swing at you. But the bottom line is he's not going to just sit there and continue to allow you to do it.
You did that to him?
I did that to him, and that's exactly what he did. He sat there and allowed it to happen.
How was he dressed? I forgot to ask.
Casually, kind of preppy.
You started rubbing, I guess, the inside of his thigh?
I started rubbing up on the inside of his thigh. It went to him actually undoing his pants. And from there, it went to fondling, and then I began to perform oral sex on him.
Where was the Indian guy at this time?
He's driving. We're actually in the limo, driving around. So I began performing oral sex. It's at that time that he actually stops to lower his pants and his shorts down past his knees, down to where they're resting around his ankles. But beforehand, he reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out a glass pipe and a packet of crack cocaine. And he actually tells me that it makes him perform better. It actually makes him stay hard longer, which I thought was somewhat interesting because most of my experiences with people who use crack cocaine, it tends to do just the opposite.
Okay.
But hey, you know, I'm one of those weird people where things react just the opposite of the way they say they're supposed to. So who knows? Maybe he is too.
Okay.
But anyway, he actually asked me to reach over because there's a lighter in the cup holder on the side there that's behind me. And he asked me to reach over and hand him the lighter. I reach over and pass him the lighter, and he starts to smoke a crack rock right there in the back of the limo.
For the benefit of the listeners, again, who don't really know, what exactly is crack?
Crack cocaine is a cooked rock form of cocaine. Cocaine, if it is not cut with a filler. And most dealers and most drug cartels will not sell you pure 100% cocaine. In most cases, you will purchase a powdered form of cocaine that is cut with something. What crack cocaine is people taking the powdered form of cocaine and cooking it in boiling water with baking soda. And after it is cooked, it starts to form into rock form. And then it's immediately filled with cold water or ice that makes those rock forms solidify.
Okay.
And then it's cut into little chunks, and then it's put inside of a pipe or on top of a soda can that someone has poked holes in the side of with a nail or a straight pin or whatever.
Right.
And it is lit with a lighter, and it is smoked, similar to a cigarette, similar to a pipe. The crack cocaine with the flame starts to melt and turns into an oily type substance. It produces a smoke that is inhaled similar to that of a cigarette that causes people to immediately get a faster high. The high is similar to that of a speed high. A lot of people who use crack cocaine get real high real fast and crash almost as fast unless they continue to smoke it over a period of time. Now, some people will argue that crack cocaine is highly addictive and people cannot be considered recreational users. If you know anything about using drugs or have been around the use of drugs, I would tend to argue that point. While most people really do become highly addicted to it, I know people that even to this day are still what you would consider recreational users that you would never in a million years believe ever touched anything, much less a crack rock or a crystal meth rock. But they do.
He lights it up, right?
He lights it up. He starts to smoke. The one thing I don't do at that point is I had experiences with crack cocaine back in the 1980s when I lived in Miami Beach, when it was first becoming the new rave. It's not something that I enjoy doing, and I simply stuck to snorting lines of coke, which is fine with me.
Where was Mr. Mutani at the time? Did they have that window that would close?
The privacy partition was still up.
And did he roll down the window a little bit to get the smoke out of the car?
Actually, I had the window cracked just a little bit.
You had a crack to get the crack out. Right? But he didn't.
No, I'm actually a smoker. I know actually that the sunroof on, or the moonroof, or whatever you want to call it, on the limo was slightly cracked. not big enough to where somebody driving by in an 18-wheeler could actually look in and see what the hell somebody was doing. But it was slightly cracked, and I've always done that no matter where I'm at or what limo.
I don't know. How fast does this stuff react? Does it react pretty quickly?
Let me explain from personal experience.
Okay.
And I will tell you from personal experience, almost within 30 seconds of inhaling the first drag that you pull off of this rock, and people need to understand, this is not something that you put the fire to and you leave the fire to it. In glass cylinder pipes for crack cocaine, it's similar to a weed pipe where you can actually put your finger over an exhaust hole and you will draw in the smoke from burning the crack cocaine with the lighter, but you remove the lighter. The one thing you don't do with crack cocaine is you don't just simply sit there and keep the fire on it until the entire rock is melted, because what you end up doing is you end up heating yourself out of most of the effects of it. But the oil itself, when you take your finger off of that hole and you allow it to cool after taking the first hit, you continue to heat up the glass pipe, and the heat turns the oil back into even more smoke that you would draw out of it and inhale. Crack cocaine has an almost instant effect on anyone. You will begin to feel the effects of smoking crack cocaine within seconds of taking that and inhaling that first hit.
Okay, and did you notice that that had happened to him?
I noticed that he definitely became a little more relaxed for a few seconds, but I also noticed that after about the second hit that he exhibited the same effects that I had seen in the 80s in Miami Beach, where you watch someone get very high very fast, and then you watch their body start reacting to the fact that they're coming down. But that's the effects of crack cocaine. Some people control it better than others. Some people need to continue to keep their level at a certain level to where they're feeling a certain effect. I've seen other people actually smoke a rock and put a pipe away and not go back to it for 2 days.
But in this case, Obama exhibited the type of behavior that you would expect a normal person would do.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, look, he took the first hit off of the rock. He definitely felt the effects of inhaling it. I tried to answer these questions based on personal experience, people that I've been around that use this stuff, as well as my own personal reactions when I tried it in 1985. Well, I had proceeded to perform oral sex on him, and you could tell that he was definitely feeling the effects from smoking the crack cocaine, because he had engaged in additional behaviors that, to me, some people would say, oh, it was a result of being high. I don't think so. I think it's a result of someone feeling comfortable with what they're doing. There were some interactions where Obama had actually started to kiss on the back of my neck while performing oral sex. Most men who simply surrender to a drunken state don't necessarily go that far. So it was obvious to me from that point that this was not something that was foreign to him. This was something that he had engaged in on previous occasions. It was something he was quite comfortable with. But basically, what ended up happening is we continued. Oral sex was completed. We continued to drive around for a while, talk, drink. And at one point, I just simply had decided that I was exhausted. I mean, I had been up constantly since returning to Colorado from South Carolina and then flying out to Chicago. And I had decided to call it a night.
Before you call it a night, you said that oral sex was completed. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, let's just say that it reached the ultimate result of ejaculation. I want to try to keep this as clean and...
Well, you know what? I mean, I think probably this may be one of the most exhaustive interviews you've done. And it is clean. The people listening to this can either turn it off or continue listening because it is explicit. But what exactly happened?
I answered this question with 100% honesty back in the summer of 2008, and I was beaten over the head with it by people from all sides, not just the Obama idiots. An explicit term was used to say that this was just too disgusting and that people were turned off by it. What I can say and will say at this point is that oral sex reached its ultimate conclusion. It didn't stop halfway, and it was a sexual encounter that terminated with the expected result.
Did his pants get dirty?
Only, I think, with him having them down on the floor of the limo and pulling them back up. But if you ask me, did his pants get stained? I don't think so.
Okay. Since we're on that topic, was he happy with what happened?
I think he was extremely happy.
So you're tired, you want to call it a night, and what happened? Did you tell him this? Did you say, look, buddy, you know, I had fun, but it's time for me to go?
Well, you know, I did. I had basically told him that, you know, I was kind of at the point to where I needed to call it a night. I had told the limo driver the same thing. It was the limo driver himself, Jagir Mutani, who had suggested that he would take me back to my hotel first and then take Obama back to wherever he was going to be taken to. The limo driver made it perfectly clear that it was more convenient for him and suggested that he take me back to my hotel first and then he would take Obama back to wherever he needed to be taken to. I had no problem with that. So that was the arrangement that was made. That's exactly the way it took place.
Okay, what time was this approximately?
We were already into the early morning hours. I'm not going to give you an exact hour because I honestly could not tell you an exact hour.
You were with him maybe for 5 hours?
From the time we met to the time that I was dropped off at the hotel, I would say at least four and a half hours.
All right.
But by this time, from a time date standpoint, it was already Sunday the 7th when I got back to my hotel.
Okay.
They dropped me back off at the hotel. I said goodnight. I was polite, made the comment that maybe if I'm ever back in the area, whatever. The general, thank you very much. Nice to meet you. So I'm actually in my hotel room Sunday the 7th when I hear a knock on the door. And when I go to answer the door and look through the peephole, imagine my surprise when I'm looking at the very gentleman that I had just engaged in oral sex earlier the night before or morning of, standing at my hotel room door.
Okay, what time was this, Blair?
It would be in the early evening of Sunday, November 7th.
Okay.
And what I have found since going public was that this would also be the anniversary of his mother's death. I answer the door. I invite him in. It's nothing more than another opportunity to engage in a sexual act that apparently he enjoyed the previous night because he's actually looking for a second round. He does enter the hotel with more cocaine, offering more to me, and I made it clear that I still had some from the night before. The incident within the hotel room, I would say, lasted a maximum of an hour and a half at the most. It was not something that I had planned for, wasn't something I had expected. It was something that took place. I was at the time of the mood and the attitude, oh, what the hell? It's not like I was busy doing anything else.
And what exactly happened?
He comes in, he makes it clear that he was looking for a second round of oral sex. This time he decides to get a little more comfortable. He's actually laying on the bed in the hotel room. At this point, his pants actually get removed to a more complete level than what they were in the back of the limo. He engages in smoking even more crack cocaine in the hotel room. I perform yet a second round of oral sex on him and pretty much get to the point to where, okay, it was nice meeting you. Great that you decided you enjoyed it enough that you wanted a round two, but I'm like, okay, I need to get ready because I'm packing, getting ready to fly out of Chicago the next morning. But what I want people to understand is you have to take this whole event in context. I never once intended to bring out anything in the campaign of 2008 about any sexual encounters with Barack Obama. That was not my intent. It was not my interest. As far as I was concerned, it really was not an issue with his candidacy. My issue with Barack Obama's candidacy was his constant claim of transparency and being a new type of politics in America and seeing people saying that the reason they support him and that they're so excited about his candidacy is because of the level of his honesty about his past drug use. Let's face it, Barack Obama is one of the first presidential candidates that's ever publicly admitted to engaging in cocaine use. And it was something that was appealing to the younger voters.
And to you, it was appalling because he's
a
liar.
To me, it was appalling because he was trying to take the benefit of admitting that he used it to appeal to the younger college crowd youth vote, while at the same time trying to appeal to the older, more straight-laced voter in saying, okay, yes, I admit to doing it, but you don't need to hold that as a negative because, let's face it, who didn't experiment with drugs in their high school and college days?
Well, Bill Clinton, but he didn't inhale.
Exactly, exactly. And see, this was exactly the way I was taking his campaign approach, that he wanted to benefit from the admission that, yeah, hey, you know, I was cool at one time, I actually did this, while at the same time not trying to look hypocritical like Bill Clinton and saying, yeah, I smoked, but I didn't inhale.
Right. How was he dressed this Sunday evening?
Again, it was quite casual. There was nothing formal about it. And when I say quite casual, I'm going to say flats and a polo type shirt. In other words, he didn't show up in coat and tie.
Okay. And in 99, did he have an afro or was he kind of closely cropped?
His hair was actually shorter, more closely cropped. If you ask me if he had hair that stood out 5 inches high, no.
Was he a very talkative fella?
You know what? Sunday he was not. And like I said, Saturday when I first met him, the talk was small talk. The one thing that I noticed about him is that he really was not into wanting people to really know who he was or what he was.
Well, that makes sense.
And I understand that. And like I said, what people need to understand is this meeting that was set up by the limo driver, at no time, and this needs to be made perfectly clear, at no time did I ever insinuate or give the limo driver any reason to believe that I was looking for sexual hookup, because
right.
I wasn't.
Now, are you, and I should have asked this earlier, but you're gay?
I am openly gay. I have been gay my entire life. I am one of those faggots, excuse my French, and I know some people will take offense to that, but I can use that term. I'm not offended by it. I tell people I am one of those faggots that never knew what the inside of a closet looked like.
Okay.
I'm one of those lifelong gay men who has known from early childhood of what my sexual preference was. I've never hidden it. I've never felt the need that I needed other people's approval or acceptance to feel comfortable with who I am or what I am. And I tend to make quite a few enemies with the gay activist segment of the population because I continue to ask them, why is it that you insist that people accept you or give you their stamp of approval in order for you to feel like you're equal?
Right. He heads out.
He heads out. There's not a problem. It becomes clear to me that his sole intent was simply he was looking to get off again, and that was pretty much it. He wasn't looking to make house. Now, what I want people to understand at the same time is the only way this man could have actually come to my hotel room was to either get the room number from the limo driver, which did have it because they had to have it in order to call me and let me know that they were on their way, as well as how to contact me for the contract that we had with them. He either had gotten the room number from the limo driver, which is exactly the way I think it happened, because even for a Comfort Inn and Suites in Gurnee, Illinois, most standard hotel policies have always been that they don't give out an individual's room number to someone just walking up to the desk asking for it. And that's just strictly liability purposes. They
right.
just don't do it.
Right.
What they normally do will tell you to pick up the house phone in the lobby, and then they will ring the room and let the guest give the room number.
Okay, did you happen to know where Obama lived at the time?
No.
Okay, so through your research, you weren't able to uncover where he actually lived in November of 99?
No.
Okay. Do you think he lived near the village of Gurnee?
No, I know he didn't live near the village of Gurnee, actually. It's interesting that you asked that, because I never did even engage in any research to try to figure out where he lived in 99. But it's my understanding that he lived in the same community that he lives in now, or lived in before being elected.
He leaves. Did you guys kiss goodbye, or?
I'm not into kissing somebody goodbye, because to me that's like you're trying to set up a long-term relationship, and that was not something I was interested in. This was basically just that. It was a chance, one night stand that turned into a two-event affair. He leaves. I don't really think about this guy. I don't even give it a second thought as to wanting to know exactly who he was. It's no different than had I been a straight person and I had met a woman at a bar and we left and grabbed a hotel room for a quick one-night stand. He leaves. I get ready. I get packed up. I have to be at O'Hare Airport the following morning. I'm flying back to Colorado, which I did. Like I said, this is not something that you dwell on. It's not something that hasn't happened probably 100 times before in my lifetime. It's not something that I leave and I start having these daydreams and I want to pick up the phone and go, oh, please, can I meet you tonight?
Right. It was done.
Yeah, it was done. When I return to Colorado, I notify my parole officer that I've returned. What I didn't do was I didn't get permission to go to Chicago at all. What I had done was I had called and left a voice message on the parole officer's voicemail telling him that I had gotten delayed and that I was extending my trip to South Carolina for an additional time period. Well, technically, that doesn't qualify as having permission from your parole officer to be out of the state. So I got a phone call and was told to go in and report, which immediately resulted in my being taken into custody and placed in the Pueblo County Jail, basically for violating parole or the conditions of parole.